Welcome to the Strength Connection Podcast, a show to share stories, insights, and experiences from some of the greatest coaches in the world. I'm Michael Kurkowski, so grateful for you joining me today. And if you like this episode, please like, share, and subscribe to support the show. All right, let's dive in. Here we go. Okay, and we are live. What's up, guys?
Not much. Great to be
good
here.
Seeing you all.
Hi, Mike.
Awesome. All right, so welcome to the Strength Connection Podcast, guys, listeners. This is very different than what you've probably listened to before because we are actually in person. We just finished a phenomenal workshop. We're going to dive into a lot of it here, but just so you know, I am with DJ Whittakin, who is back on the podcast, and we are in his space right now in Queen City Kettlebell in Cincinnati, Ohio for the Mind the Gap workshop. And first time on the podcast, Mark Sudis. Mark, thanks so much for jumping on, man. Appreciate it. Mark's been in this community for a long time, and the man to my right, no introduction needed. He's been on here probably as much as I have, pretty much by now.
Pretty close.
I am with Brett Jones, who led this workshop here. Guys, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Great to be on. Thank you.
Awesome. So, so we just finished a lot of information. Okay, so we're going to dive into Mind the Gap a bit first, and then we'll go into a bunch of different directions. There's probably going to be a shitload of movie quotes in here because that's what we do. Mark will probably have some stories about the real actors in these movie quotes because he's worked with them before. But anyways, we're just going to have a good time. So, all right. So, Brett, I just want to start with you. So this is Mind the Gap. Mm-hmm. And I tried to have this answered last night as we were out to dinner, and the microphone did not work. Technology freaking is awesome. So in your mind, what does Mind the Gap mean when we're talking about strength?
Okay, so when you're following a minimalist routine, which I do, I clean, I press, I squat, do some swings and snatches. I'm not doing 30 different exercises. I'm not on a rotation of exercises. I've been cleaning, pressing, squatting, swinging, and snatching for almost 4 years now on the same sort of protocol. What I started to realize was that minimalist routine does leave some gaps. So it can be a mobility gap, stability gap, or strength gap. And so the idea behind Mind the Gap is to fill those when they appear. And that's what the workshop was all about, and how to identify your canaries in the coal mine, the things from a movement, stability, or strength perspective that you need to have an eye on, because when that backslides, that's your warning light indicator on your dashboard to say, okay, I need to spend a little more time getting ready, or I need to fill that gap just a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did this come about, like, for you? I mean, you've been doing this work with minimalists for a while. Obviously, you've known of this before and then put it together in a program. So when did this kind of come about, and how did it come about in that way?
It's an evolution of everything I've done with FMS and Strong First, really, because almost 4 years into following the Iron Cardio Protocol, as I developed that and built it out, as strong as I was getting and as quote fit as I was getting, I also realized there were some gaps. My single leg strength had taken a backslide. I needed to make sure my ankles, hips, and T-spine stayed mobile, because with situations at my hips and a couple other medical things that I've dealt with, I just need to make sure those pieces and parts stay open. So as I don't have hours a day to train, so I fit my training in. And so Mind the Gap came about as a way to stay healthy, feel good, and continue to progress in my training. So it just kind of a natural evolution as I progressed and realized I needed to fill some gaps.
Yeah. So you guys just went through this with me. I got a lot of takeaways from this that I want to get into. But before I hijack it on that, what was the takeaways that you guys got from going into this today?
I think for me, being a host and wanting to take the workshop, you start to wear many hats. But the one thing is, you step back and look, for me, I noticed two things. Is every time I do an in-person workshop, whether I'm teaching or I'm taking, it's always the devil's in the details, right? Like, that's always why I want to go to these things, because that's knowledge, that's experience that, you know, we pick up on as we coach, as we spend time in this industry. It's just the little things that make such a big difference, that Brett's experience, it's going to work for him. And then Mark's going to chime in with something else. And then some of the other coaches were in here, were like, I tried this. And the next thing you know, that's how this big brainstorming session happens. And we walk onto something, you know, bigger. But the other aspect, and I really noticed it today, was I think sometimes even as professionals, we take our knowledge for granted. And I talk about this a lot of times with my interns and the people who work here with us. You know, we've been doing this so long, I think we forget where we've come from. And with a lot of the minimalist approach that Brett provided today, you're like, oh yeah, I do know that. While there's other people in here that it's just dawning on them for the first time. Well, they might not be brand new in the industry. They spent some time, but maybe they weren't exposed to it, or there's a gap in their knowledge. Whenever reason, I started to see that as a light bulb started to go off in the room as we were training. So I think those were the two biggest takeaways for me was the devil's in the details, I'm adding to the toolbox. Now, how do I address that where maybe I'm taking my knowledge for granted as I start to teach other people? And yeah.
I think that's a good point too, because like I know just from coaching, like you, especially if you're working with new people, you're kind of doing a lot of similar stuff over and over again. So you can almost get a little complacent because, and forget about those details a lot at that time. So I know like just from doing that, I've been doing this stuff with you for a while. And I just picked up so many things. Like, oh, I was way rushing through this. Like I forgot about the locked up ankle that I had. I was like, yeah, I need to take that a little bit more. That awareness of it comes into place. And I think as you mentioned, you can get so into your own knowledge base and think that everybody knows this stuff all the time. And you forget just to go back to where you started from before. Yeah, that was a good point.
Yeah, I think for me, it's definitely the community aspect and the knowledge. And I followed you, Brett, for a long time and have admired you. I admire Mike, I admire DJ, and I fortunately came to know everybody here through Strong First. And the student of strength aspect, I think, is probably one of my favorite things, because even today, you know, it was a small, very focused group of people who were all professionals and very on point. But there was everybody is a student aspect. And I have these injuries where there were things we did today that I would probably make an excuse, but I decided to just try it, go for it. And I felt safe in the room. The instruction was superb. So it was a great, great session for me.
Yeah. Awesome. There's something to the immersiveness too of just the in-person stuff. Like
yeah.
It's been a while since I did a workshop like this. And I'm sure you can pick up stuff as you're teaching, because this was the first one of this specific thing, yeah. You know, from here. So going through it now, like going through the first one, how did you feel that it went? Was there any more things that you want to do to kind of emphasize going forward? Kind of.
Yeah, it's always interesting. No plan survives contact with the enemy. And I don't want to call the attendees enemies.
Is that from Mars Attack?
Exactly. It's a lot of information to cover in 4 hours.
That's why we went over. Yeah.
It wasn't even enough. It could have gone on for two more hours.
Oh, so, absolutely.
That time just went by so freaking fast. I was like, I don't know, maybe I'm used to like long workshops at it to like condense everything into 4 hours. Like, shit, how's he going to do it?
Yeah, well, I didn't.
Yeah.
So I think picking and choosing just a little bit more what we cover. And, you know, if this was a group of 30 people, there's no way we would have made it through everything that we tried to cover. So a small group allowed me to cover, you know, a lot more. So there's some things that I'm spinning around in my head for next time, just to make sure we get through everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I can teach one thing and relate it to two other things and not have to cover the two other things. So just trying to do that algebra in my head of how I'm going to cover it more efficiently.
Yeah. Explain the canary in the coal mine analogy again from there. So first off, I didn't know what was the history behind that, because that just threw me for a loop for like 3 minutes.
Yeah. So it's Welsh coal mining. Uh-huh. From the 1800s,
okay.
Where what they, you know, as canaries are more sensitive to changes in the atmosphere than we are. So down in a coal mine, when you run into CO2 or a methane vein and the atmosphere changes and it's toxic or not hospitable to humans, the canary notices that first, and they will start to squawk and react. And in worst case scenarios, they don't make it. Mm-hmm. But the humans in the room know, uh-oh, the canary is getting upset, or the canary fell over. We need to get out of here. And so it was a safety check. And they actually just stopped doing it in the 1980s. So they were taking canaries down in the coal mines with them from the 1800s until 1980, because it was that successful.
Why did they stop?
Sensors, okay. That they actually upgraded into, you know, the modern era, and sensors told them when the air was changing. Mm-hmm. But they saw no reason to upgrade until the 1980s because the canary was working. Mm-hmm. And so that mindset, I think that is just an appealing, easily transmitted mindset to folks that, you know, the other one would be the warning light on the dashboard, right? But we're so used to ignoring that warning light on the dashboard that most people who own a car, that's not a good analogy.
No, you put the tape over it.
It's making a noise. Turn the stereo up. Yep. But canary in the coal mine, like it has that uniqueness to it from a cueing standpoint or something that's going to stick in the brain. And I think if we keep an eye on things like that, I think we do better over time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel a lot of times mobility kind of like gets reduced to just, you know, stretching and warm up, but obviously taking the idea of mobility in the gap that you have in your training, how do you find improving that? Is there an unconventional approach to taking that to your general population of people? Do you feel that changes when you're dealing with athletes? Because the game totally changes with athletes. It's all about being, you know, whatever sport it is that they're playing. You know, kind of share your insights to that. Because like I said, it's a lot of people have that kind of misconception of what mobility is.
Sure. I think for Gen Pop, for people that may not have a higher performance goal, we're managing our minimums. There's a baseline that I don't want you to fall under. And as long as we keep you on the other side of that minimum baseline, you will move well enough to have a positive response to the training that we're going to do. That's the FMS principle number one: move well, move often. I need you to move well enough to have a positive adaptation to the stress we're going to put you under. And all I got to do to achieve that is keep you above the minimums. Just don't fall below the baseline. Now, when we transfer that into an athlete or somebody that has a higher level goal, now I got to start shooting for a couple maximums. There's a couple things within that sport that if I optimize those, with a golfer, if I don't optimize T-spine, they're going to have a different swing.
You mean I can't rotate from my lumbar all day?
A few times. But that extra degree you're getting out of your lumbar. But yeah, so there's when you take it into the athletic realm, you look at what the demands of that sport are and you say, okay, for this person, ankle mobility is going to be a priority. For this person, T-spine mobility is going to be the priority. And so it's almost like the baseline doesn't change, but now I'm looking for maximums, not just minimums.
Okay. Can I piggyback off that?
Oh, do you think? Yeah.
So as far as like buy-in, I feel like maybe it's easier for a certain demographic of people. How do you address those misconceptions, right? That like, I need to go out and I got to get stronger, right? That's the big thing. We got to get stronger, stronger, stronger. But applying the principles from today and filling those gaps or filling the cups, how do you like address those misconceptions?
So buy-in is everything. And buy-in usually has to do with magnifying the problem so it comes to their awareness. It's one thing if I can see it. Like if I screen you and I find a restricted ankle, cool. But are you aware of it?
Yeah.
Because if you don't feel the difference in that restricted ankle, if you don't feel the difference in how you turn to the right versus how you turn to the left, convincing you that this is something you need to be working on is really difficult. So, and Gray tried to pound this into my head for years, that the goal of a corrective was to magnify the problem. And I'm like, what are you talking about? The goal of a corrective is to fix the problem. What are you? And then, of course, years later, it's like, oh yeah, the goal of a corrective is to magnify the problem so that you become aware of it. And when we got into certain positions today, I think Mark, maybe you had the experience of being able to turn easily one direction, but more difficult in the other. Like having that magnified and brought to your attention where I put you in a certain position where only the quote right thing can happen. Now, if you can't do it, that right left difference kind of blows up in your brain and it's like, well, I could do it to this side. Why can't I do it to that side? That is usually all the buy-in you need.
Okay.
And especially with an athlete or somebody that is a little more driven, when you find something they quote can't do, you just kicked over the anthill. They're going to do everything. Yeah, exactly.
That's interesting. I never heard that of magnifying the problem. That's the focus of a corrective exercise. It makes more understanding. Yeah. It makes more sense.
Yeah.
Sorry. It took me so long, Gray.
I think it also relates to how the medicine is served, who the coach is, how they are describing this information and how they respond to you. Because I've had a variety of coaches over the years and variety of injuries over the years. And some people are determined to help you fit into what they think is the ideal of strength. And some people really focus on what you're doing. And what we're talking about today is so hyper-specific that when you do highlight the problem, if there's a solution, it helps that person feel more motivated because they're going to get there. And understanding the issue is so important, so basic.
Yeah, I'm going to piggyback on that for just a second, because the empowerment that happens from when I place you in a position to magnify an issue or something that you can't do, and then you're there, then aware of, and you feel it change. It is no longer my movement. It is no longer my assessment. It is your movement. It is you taking ownership of that. And then from that day forward, you can manage that. If you keep an eye on it, if you establish that as a canary in the coal mine and you keep an eye on it, you should be able to manage it. And then if the usual things don't work, well, now come back. I might have another thing to move the needle just a little bit more in that direction. So I look at this as, I'm not trying to put myself out of a job or anything, but, in the end, the people that I work with should be able to manage their movement. Now, old Tai Chi master saying that I heard was, I make a living teaching the forms, I make a fortune on corrections. So there's always something to polish up. There's always something to clean up, and that's the coach's eye. But I think there's a lot of empowerment from taking ownership on some of these movement things and having it magnified. It's not a negative, it's a positive.
Yeah. I think what I got from that too, is just the awareness that you give to somebody, that's what I got from magnifying the problem. It's like, that sounds kind of harsh if you don't know the context, but this is the neuroscience, research, your brain believes you, it doesn't believe me.
Exactly.
So you can correct every fucking thing that you absolutely want to, forever. But if you don't actually understand why it's corrected for your own body, then it's not going to stick afterwards. So that's what I got from that. Show them, are you feeling this? Then they can get their correction. Then they can work it out. And then they actually become confident in what's going on in their own body from there.
Yep.
I did that for a while. I was always the guy, I was a great soldier, a great student. Yeah. Just tell me what to do.
Yeah.
And you can get a certain place in a certain way to get there, but if you don't take ownership of it, and I think that's where I think a lot of coaches do have struggles, specifically early on, is you're telling everybody what to do, which will give them a certain point, because they are just from doing something different, they're going to make some changes, but eventually that's going to hit just an enabling stall tactic from there.
Sure.
Yeah. It's true.
Yeah. So we did go a lot into, there's a lot of mobility work that we went into today, which is awesome. And the question that I had as we were going through is, if you focus so much on mobility, will the basics pretty much cover everything else as far as strength? Because what I thought, just a little context is, I was like, is there other strength exercises you need to add in to the basic movements that you're doing with strength? Where now it was more eye-opening, really is focused on mobility and feeling good. And then you can go into the basics, because that's really going to give you the most bang for your buck.
Yes. So if we check all the boxes on the mobility and we don't have any stability gaps, then a little bit of single leg work, a little bit of windmill and get up. And I think you check a lot of boxes from a strength perspective, as far as staying a little more rounded out. Within a very simple protocol like iron cardio, where we're cleaning, we're pressing, we're squatting, it's very simple. I get into a bunch of different things based off of that limited number of exercises that I'm doing. And I'm still good at bent presses. I'm still good at one arm push-up. I've still got my pull-ups. I've still got, all those other things are either maintaining or improving as I'm making changes, improvements within this very limited number of things that I'm doing. I think if you check some of those boxes, and keep the mobility open, mobility gives you the ability to apply your strength in different areas. Mm-hmm. If your mobility becomes limited by your strength, and I'm thinking powerlifters right now, who can develop a lot of upper body restrictions due to bench press, they kind of bang up their hips a little bit because they're trying to squat to get the most weight up. They end up changing their mobility and only being good in those specific patterns. But if you have a well-rounded mobility practice and you fill some of the gaps as far as single leg strength, and then I think the windmill and the get up are these hybrid, stability, strength, mobility catch-alls that can really help people stay balanced out.
Mask, what is your opinion on Cars? Not the 80s band or the delightfully animated film, but the articulated rotations. I don't know. I actually don't know. It's because they seem to encompass mobility and an area of strength.
Yeah, it's, you can, so.
For context, controlled articular rotations.
Controlled articular rotations, yeah.
I'm gonna take the answer in a maybe a direction that doesn't seem like it applies at first. You can do isolated joint range of motion testing at every joint, and you will find joints that don't do what they're supposed to do. Like if you look at me from a isolated range of motion standpoint, I will not have the hip internal rotation that I should have. And if you bang away at that, you're going to irritate me. And not just mentally, you're going to tear up my hip and you're going to really cause me some problems. Yeah. So the mobility work, I think how you move in more global patterns is more instructive than how you move at one particular joint. So should you be able to move all of your joints through their available range of motion, which may be limited or changed by your structure or previous history? Should you be able to move all your joints through all the range of motion that you have access to? Yes. But there are global movement patterns that give me a much quicker way to check that. And so can controlled articular rotations be a great part of a program? Yes. But how much training time and training load are you willing to dedicate towards doing every joint in your body through all of these articular rotations when you might be taking 30 minutes away from your actual training time? I don't have two and a half hours to train. I don't have, when I work with a new student, I don't have 3 hours to do an assessment. I need to be done in 15 minutes. So the rest of the 45 minutes of the hour session, I can get them doing something that moves the needle for them. So I just choose to look at it from more of a global movement pattern first. Then if I need to drill down and find a specific, what I'm going to refer to as area of opportunity or restriction, then I'll do that.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool that we started with like the warm up and kind of dove into it a bit. And then we finished it at the end where we went through it very quickly. On there. First off, I realized I'm spending way too much time doing that. I could probably cut down like 5 minutes at least from going on here. And I know that was by reason that you did that. So was that more to realize like, you don't need to take this stuff like so seriously, like get through it, like just, and you probably train your brain to understand it a little bit quicker. The quicker you can get through the warm-ups, you can get some fun stuff.
Yeah. Gray has always said, I might skip steps, but I don't miss steps. And those are two very different things.
Sounds so great.
Yeah. And I know he's going to be on.
And that's all elaborate for 30 minutes.
Exactly. From a mobility standpoint, I think there are certain boxes that you need to check. And then as I go into a get up with an arm bar and a bent arm bar and the bridge at the elbow, and I do my windmills and single leg, like I'm checking tons of boxes, but I just need to check the box and move on. If my warm up cannot become my training. And that happened with breathing. That's happened with mobility. That's happened with a bunch of different things that become popular. And pretty soon out of an hour session, you spent 35 minutes doing some breathing drills. What are you training?
Yeah.
Like I'm a meathead. I want to press the bell. I want to get my work in. Work training is mental health for me, right? It is how I get out a lot of stress. It's how I deal with a lot of things. It is not only my physical health, it's my mental health. And if I'm spending 30 minutes of a 45 minute session, which is usually all the time I have to train, if I'm obsessing over a particular joint that isn't 100% where I want it, and I'm not taking care of my training, I just think I'm headed the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. It's just me.
Yeah. You were talking about this before, because I was the same way, like don't like to warm up too quickly, just kind of go right into like the good stuff right
off. I've gotten older. I've learned the error of my ways many times, but I'm also a big fan of applying those correctives or applying the mobility into the lift, right? I still sometimes train one lift at a time. That's okay with me. Maybe I'll throw in some ankle rotations while I'm squatting. Maybe I'll do this. I've been known to prescribe that for a lot of people, and the answer is always the same. Like, during the main lift, question mark, yeah. You know, you're like, yeah, man, like, yeah, if it's going to make you better, keep doing it. Mm-hmm. Right. But, if it makes you feel better and, you know, it's not causing you any harm, if you're lifting for one rep max and it's not taking away from it, why would you not do it? Right. It's making you better. I think it's the same way with cars. I think if it's making you feel better and it's not causing you harm and it's not causing you anything, any issues long-term, just do it. Right. A lot of people aren't doing anything, you know, people tend to make fun of some of these Mickey Mouse type of stuff, and cars included, honestly. But you know what? People are doing it. Mark's doing it. He feels great when he does it. Keep doing it, dude. You're getting better. Absolutely. So, and I've had to do little things like that in my training. Like, okay, I got to spend extra 5 minutes warming up. I got to spend, you know what? Yesterday was a rough night. I got to spend 10 minutes. Right. Warming up. Like, it just is what it is. But you're playing the equity game over time. And I think people forget about that. They want the quick fixes. You know, exactly what Brett said. It worked so well, I stopped doing it. Well, you know, it's not a linear approach. It has its, you know, its ups and downs, and you have to account for that a lot of times. Yeah.
Yeah. So I do. I think like the work with cars, I've done cars before stuff, and not even just to focus so much on cars, but I think you can get so much into, I remember I had this guy, his client, and I was training him for a short period of time, and he had a 1 hour, like, original strength and like mobility warm up that he had to do beforehand.
An hour. Oh dear.
When I just said, I'm like, dude, I'm not hanging out there for an hour back when you're done, and then we're going to start training. So we did like a 10 minute type warm up session. It was more like a lot of technique stuff. Actually realized he was a lot better after just doing it for like 10 minutes, just hitting it on the spot. It always is interesting of just how people like get into this thought process of thinking they need to do so much things over and over again. And I think, you know, one of the big points, as you said, is like, maybe a lot of people only have 20, 25 minutes to train. Even if you have more, I think it's good to know how to train in that short 20, 25 minute time frame, because you might not have that time later in the line. That was one of the questions that one of my community asked, like, what's the best duration of time, you know, to work with? It's like, well, that's probably what you have. Yeah. But if you know how to get everything that you need to done in 25, 30 minutes, it's probably going to be a really good tool in the tool belt.
100%. I work with people that are having their first or second kids. Yeah, you don't have 45 minutes to work out. You know, an hour is a dream. 45 minutes is probably not going to happen. 30 minutes is maybe going to happen once a week. You've got 15 to 20 minutes to get something in. And most people's reaction when you say, I've only got 20 minutes to train is, well, why bother? No, bother. Definitely bother with that, because that can be as simple as the 5 minute ground-based movement we did into a couple of deadlifts or single leg deadlifts and swing for 10 minutes. That 20 minutes can be optimized so that you move the needle, you feel better, you move better, you're a better parent, you're a better person because you got your work in. And the human machine needs movement. Mm-hmm. Period.
If you're really good, you can double swing your twins.
Yeah, exactly.
Really just get in there and do
3 minutes out of class.
Yeah. Let's like, go. Like, get 300 in.
Definitely. Yeah. Optimizing the time is really, really important.
Yeah. I have a new dad that I'm working with right now, and we're just doing an iron cardio. That's why I think iron cardio is so phenomenal. It's because 10 minutes at a clip of just getting everything that you need to done at a specific spot. So powerful.
Well, have you tried the iron cardio plus swings variation?
No.
So what I fell
doing
into.
Doing enough swings right now.
Yes, you are. What I fell into during when I came up with the idea for Simple and Sinister February, which as soon as I hit send on the draft for the newsletter, I was like, damn it. Now I have to do it. Because I can't recommend it to everybody else and not, you know, follow through. So I did it. And one of the variations I came up with was clean press squat on the left, 5 swings on the left. There's a break between those. Clean press squat, set it down, shake it off. 5 swings, set it down, shake it off. Clean press squat right, set it down, shake it off. 5 swings on the right. And so in 40 sets, you can get your 100 swings in. You get 20 sets of iron cardio, tremendous amount of work. It happens within about 20 minutes. 20 to 30 minutes. You can obviously do less, do more. And oddly enough, the swings kind of level out the heart rate so that it's actually a really neat session. And now, instead of saying, oh, I'm doing an iron cardio day or I'm doing swings, well, let's put those two together. And now your 15 minutes is swings and iron cardio, and it has a different effect. It's a really nice variation.
Sounds just fun.
Really nice. Yes.
Nice.
That's
nice.
Nice.
Yeah. That's cool. You said something. There's a couple things that you said that I wanted to harp on. One is, we'll stay with this because we've been talking about mobility, is the word you used about 20 times today was gentle.
Yes.
So when you talk about that, it's like with mobility, do you think like we go too hard on mobility, like trying to like almost like PR the mobility before we get into strength training?
I love that. 100%, 100%. You know, we have a joke in the Strong First community, if brute force isn't working, you're not using enough. And we're not talking about mobility work and flexibility work. At the joke that I make with people all the time, and they, you know, you get the little light bulb moment. When was the last time you enjoyed being forced to do something? I mean, there was one time in college for me, but outside of that, you know, I don't enjoy being forced to do things. Nobody does. Well, I mean, I guess maybe somebody out there does, but most people don't enjoy being forced to do things. Well, your body's the same way. If you ask in the right way, it should be given, right? So mobility and flexibility, that's how I think of mobility and flexibility. If I ask the right question, if I put you in the right position, if I allow your body to give me that thing that I'm asking for, way more sustainable, way easier to achieve and maintain. It's just a better way to go about it.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
I think that falls under a good prevention measure that you talked about today in a couple of passings. I don't know if everybody picked up on it, but sometimes you have to learn, you know, for yourself, but for other people, you got to learn to hit the brakes. And that just doesn't mean stopping, but maybe just go a little slower. You don't go as hard. You don't drive as fast. And people, we're all guilty of it. They just smash the brakes. But remember when you learn to drive, I'm sorry, they smash the gas, but remember when you learn to drive, you have to learn to hit the brakes too. And the first thing you do, you know, you go too hard, and it's this subtle art of balancing how hard, how fast, how intense to go. So it's an interesting, a bunch of interesting concepts in there with that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I pulled in one of the Roadhouse rules of be nice until it's time to not be nice.
The original Roadhouse.
The original Roadhouse. And
the Swayze Roadhouse.
Exactly.
Not the Muppet.
It's our second episode. It's Roadhouse review.
Now I just want to see Gonzo as Dalton. But the, in general, if you will be nice to your body, if you will ask, if you will coax these things out, let them happen, way more sustainable. There is a time to not be nice. And just as in Roadhouse, you don't know when that is. I am the cooler, you are the bouncer. You know, that's the role of a coach, to say, okay, the nice approach, the gentle approach hasn't worked. Let's take things up a notch and see if we can, you know, get through this baseline that we want to get to. That's a better way to approach it, in my opinion. And I quoted Groucho Marx today with, you know, these are my principles. If you don't like them, I have others. These are my opinions. If you don't like them, I have others. Mm-hmm. So anybody that's out there getting triggered by the fact that I'm like not all over cars, I'm sorry.
How dare you?
Yeah, I know. I don't think it's that serious.
Or Rick Ocasek.
No, it's a great point. I like what you said about just, you know, people pumping the brakes, like, and, you know, not knowing when to slow down. I've used this analogy in my community called the highway of strength. Like when you learn how to drive, a lot of times we always think like a program is it's like a train track. It's one line. Like, this is the speed. This is what you do. The program fits into your life. And if anything goes off, then the whole train is derailed. More, it's like a highway. It's like every lane on the highway, there's a reason for it. They're all going at different speeds, but they're all going forward. So the more, you know, yeah, maybe like what you're set up to do is maybe like a middle lane or a left lane, but you got to also know, like, you can go into the right lane. Like, yeah, you're going a little bit slower, but sometimes cruise control is okay to work with. And it's hard sometimes, I think, to get into, because I mean, people have stressful lives. They like kind of need to understand this. So there's a lot of awareness that needs to come into the body, which kind of brought me into, you know, we worked with a group of professionals today, like people have been doing this for a long time. So there's a little bit of a body awareness, working with more of like a beginner, like going into this of getting set, do you approach it differently? Like with the mind the gap mentality, like is we need to get our strength for we're done and then we'll figure out the gaps afterwards. How do you approach that?
The mobility gap and the mobility baseline is one I'm going to set first for everybody. Doesn't matter if you've been training for 30 years or you just started. Mobility, I'm going to check that. I'm going to make sure you move well enough to have a positive adaptation. You got a restricted ankle and I want you to do squats. Good luck. You're not going to respond well or in a positive fashion to that stress. So the mobility gap is first. It's a baseline. It's something I'm going to check right away. I won't know if you have a specific stability or strength gap until I get a little further down the road. So definitely mobility first. For somebody that doesn't have a lot of body awareness, again, foam roller. Purely for the proprioceptive input. The rolling around on the ground, the entry-level body weight strength training, and the proprioceptive input, that starts them learning their body better. And that has a lot of benefits as we move forward. So, yeah.
The foam roller. That's great.
Many groans today.
I just had it in my mind. I just totally lost it.
It was probably the best question.
It was the best question.
Now it's gone.
Now it's gone. Oh, so we talked about the wrist and hand positions, and I have to bring this up. It's because when you put the hands up like this, like there's a different way of setting the kettlebell. Why have we not taught that?
Mike and I were today, we're like, what? This should be the first thing that we're told.
Yeah.
Because you'll have a coach sometime who'll say, you do it this way. This is the way you do it, as per what you described today. And it takes a while to try to understand why that isn't working. And sometimes you don't know. So you explained it today very succinctly.
Well, believe me, I was really upset with myself that I was 20 years into this or 19 years into this when I finally realized there's three different basic wrist archetypes that we needed to adjust the grip for. And, you know, I mean, it was definitely a, you know, wish I had a V8 sort of moment. And I started discussing it with Fabio. We talked with Dr. Kathy Dooley.
She's my PT coach.
Yeah, she's awesome.
She's the best.
So, but she understands the anatomy to a level that I don't. And so in speaking to her, she was able to validate and put some details to what we were finally discovering 20 years down the road. Of how to adjust the grip specific to the hand and wrist architecture. I think that was one of the best. I started adjusting people's feet and using the lock and rock drill to set squat, swing, deadlift stances years ago, many, many years ago. It took me until then to realize there's a lock and rock sort of situation for the upper body, because anytime you're pushing and moving force through the hands, military press, whatever the case may be, bench press, military press. When you're pushing weight through the body, how you align that hand and wrist is really going to matter, especially with the offset center mass, the kettlebell.
Yeah. I remember a while ago, like I got so pissed because Fabio brought out that like pinky side type work. And I was like, oh, like my press is going to fucking shot up right now. It did not. I was like, I thought I just lost all aspects of how to train with the belt, because I was like, well, this is what they're saying in here. Like, this is what you need to do. So I don't know if you guys have ever played around with positions like that.
I have, but
that absolutely like threw me for a loop.
That's how I injured or irritated. I didn't really injure them, but I irritated both my shoulders, and how we ended up understanding the wrist archetypes and really making these adjustments.
I just want to say for a moment, the reason that I can do half the things I can do today are because of Kathy Dooley. I met her when I was going to do a level 2 cert. And there's a guy named Jason Kapnick who had this spot down called Catalyst downtown. It's not there anymore. And Kathy was a strength coach and PT guru, everything. And I started seeing her, and she literally has changed my life. Between Kathy and Tim Barrett, who's my longtime coach who introduced me to SFG, I wouldn't be able to squat. And her understand, she still dissects cadavers.
Like, yep.
She actually really understands the human body more than anyone I've met.
100%.
I send people to her who are really serious about their bodies, not just lay people, because she's the real deal.
100%. And if I have an anatomical question, that's who I reach out to.
Sounds like Kathy Dooley needs a follow on Instagram.
I wrote down the name Kathy. You will be hearing from me soon. It sounds like we've got a lot to talk about from there. So have you played around with that stuff, like with the position?
So I like the cheat that you came up with. So here's the free mind the gap thing. Just throw the hands up, right? Yeah. I've never played with that. That was an interesting cheat. But I always tell people adjust your hands. And this is where, you know, the duality of going to assert comes into play. It's like, you have to have a standard. I get that. But the standards are so subjective. And that's really what we need to be talking about. And I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, but I've definitely been to organizations and certs where it's like, well, it has to be that you have to use your pinky. Meanwhile, their forearms are screaming. They're getting that axial load. And, you know, we're not taking certain things in consideration. So now having that cheat sheet, and then now I can apply that with people saying, hey, move it down to the pinky, or maybe you want to be more mid, or, you know, really driving into the web of your thumb to find that perfect spot. So I like that a lot, but I've never put that together. And then what I was thinking as you were explaining that is anybody else like excited? Because you're right, we've changing squat position and deadlift position, swing positions. And we're like, why weren't we doing this 5 years ago? Yeah. And the same thing, why weren't I doing this 5 years ago? Like, what are we going to be saying in 5 years? Like, why wasn't I doing that 5 years ago? Like, yeah. It's always interesting to me to think about the things that I haven't discovered yet, or I haven't been taught, that definitely keeps me in this industry and excited to talk to people and, you know, be on the podcast.
Yeah.
You know, shoot each other messages and just, you know, chop it up. Cause you don't, I think after COVID too, we lost that ability. And that was one of my questions too, is, you know, these in-person seminars, they need to come back, and they need to come back in a big way. And I think this is a great intro to that. And I think what we went over today is very valuable. So especially to coaches.
Having Brett come over and make the slightest adjustment that changes everything. You couldn't really do that on Zoom. You can do a version of that on Zoom. Zoom is very helpful, and I've certainly used it much in my career and my training since the pandemic. But there isn't really anything like the hands-on, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like you can eat a half-baked brownie, and it's good, but it's not a full brownie.
That sounds disgusting, actually.
Does that mean are we going to order the
I just want some chocolate.
That sounded so awesome in my head. And I was like, you know, I don't know if this completely plays out on that. But
should we talk about dinner last night?
No, I like what you said with the, you know, it's like, why did I not know this at other times? And I think that's always something you can say with it. And I think that's just the aspect of learning. Like, you just keep working it over and over again. You know, like, I'm a huge baseball fan. And I think I always love seeing is like when you get to a certain level with the swing, guys can just make a little adjustment in their swing and all of a sudden there it is again. Yeah. So it's just the more you keep aware of it, it's huge. And it is it's a power of immersiveness too. You know, I mean, this was a relatively short workshop in four and a half, five hours, you know, compared to some other ones there, but it's still like such a deep dive into it. Like, you get so much immersed, and so much of what we do, it's like you get little touch points here and there and stuff like that. It is the power of an in-person workshop. Yeah. And getting there, and not just for coaches, but people are just the practitioners of this, of getting in, because they're going to have insights and different feedback of getting in too. You know, like, people have different jobs and they're working like crazy. I just had Artemis Stanilidis back on the podcast, who went from coaching to working corporate 9 to 5 for a couple of years. Now back to coach, he's just like, I had no idea what people's lives are like when they're like in 9 to 5. Like, you kind of get jaded out of that. So yeah, that immersiveness that goes in is huge.
Yeah, I'm a civilian.
I know.
I was so intimidated by my first cert that I actually, two things happened. I didn't want to go when I'd done all the training, and my coach was like, you're going. Mm-hmm. And then I was so freaked out about snatch test that after the second day, I thought, well, I can't do this test. I'm going to put it on video. I'll do it at my leisure. Somebody will record me. So I wrote to John Ingham. I'm like, hi. So I'm not going to do the snatch test tomorrow. I'm too stressed. So I'm just going to send you a video. He goes, yeah, I know you're doing the test. And then I went home, panicked, and I called Tim Barrett, my coach, and he said, what I want you to do is meditate for 5 minutes, lie in bed, and do the entire snatch test with your eyes closed. I want you to visualize the entire test and then get up in the morning and do it. And Hannah Fons was the person who counted my snatch test, and I did it without scratching a finger. It was amazing. It was a really helpful thing. And it was like between John and her getting over the fear, because even people who are coaches were afraid, were nervous about
I've been more nervous as an assistant counting somebody's snatch test than actually going in and doing
it. You want me to pay attention for 5 minutes?
I'm like in this like zone of like, yes, one, two. And then they put the bell down and you have to remember which one that
yeah.
It's the stress.
I got clickers on the wall. Those things are worth their weight in gold. You gotta have the clickers, man.
100%. So, because I remember my first one we used to do on the first day, which was like way different. So the first day,
SFG1, you did it on the first
when day. The early days of the RKC, they did the snatch test first, level one. Right. And then I think they realized that a lot of people's snatch technique was so bad.
Yeah.
Like, just that, like, we need to teach some people some stuff first. The first thing you did, it's like, hi, everybody, bring your bell outside. Let's do a max effort test after a five minute warm up and go.
Yep.
But then the rest of the weekend was really easy.
Yeah. once you could step off that peak.
Well, that is the best thing about assisting. You show up, you put your bag down, you do the snatch test, and then you go to work.
Yeah, yep. Things definitely adjust afterwards from there, which is fun. So this was an interesting question that I got. I kind of just opened it up is, they're asking about RPE, like, how do you know what your RPE is?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think I've been training with kettlebells for over 21 years. And I think I'm just starting to understand RPE. But here's the biggest thing I'll say. It is an ongoing conversation. It is not a set scientific formula.
Yeah.
What you perceive to be an RPE of 7 today will be an RPE of 6 at some other point. So as long as you start having the conversation and you start tracking it and trying to understand why you're giving it that number, you will end up in a good place. I use the volume knob analogy when I work with people's swings and to get them to dial in the right amount of effort. So 10 is max effort, 1 is kind of tried, and I'll have a person do a set of swings and I'll say, okay, put that on the scale of 1 to 10. Oh, it was a 6. Well, from an outside perspective, it was 11.
Okay. Those swings go up to 11 and the spinal tap that up.
So from an outside perspective, it's like, yeah, you definitely chose the speakers that go to 11. But I don't argue. It's their number, right? Okay, that was a 6. Give me a 3. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, give me a 3. Turn the volume knob down. Just you know, forgetting Sarah Marshall. Less. Just this, but less. But invariably what happens is their swing cleans up, their swing is better, it feels better to them, and they're actually more powerful. And so there's a big difference between what they were perceiving to be high effort. And if you try too hard, you just get in your own way. I think maybe everybody's had the experience of trying to throw a ball and putting it 6 feet in the dirt in front of you and then relaxing and throwing the ball and you launch it into your home plate. So that sort of same thing happens with RPE. Ongoing conversation. Let's just start putting numbers on it and let's say, one of the ways that I look at it now, especially from a military press perspective, is if I pick up the 32 and it feels like a 24, I know my RPE is down on that low. And then the 36 starts to feel like a 32. My RPE dropped at that load. So that's how I'm starting to track a little bit more RPE from a strength perspective. From a conditioning or cardiovascular perspective, it is very in the moment as far as where you think that RPE is.
Yeah. We use auto-regulation here all the time. And it's the same thing when you have your clients record their weights, you know, as long as they're consistent in how they measure or how they track, I think that's the big key. With RPE as a coach, I think we put too much of the onus on us as coaches because that's our job, right? You need to feel a certain way. Man, Brett got in a fight with his wife last night and Mike's neighbors were up partying all night. You know, there's too many variables to take into account, but as long as, you know, the client or the athlete is consistent in measuring it, that's all that matters. And they can do, you know, I got a guy that I had to make the emoji smiley faces. He has 5 emoji smiley faces and that dictates our RPE. That's something that he knows, right? But you know, if you ask a client, how much did you bench? And they're like 60 pounds. And I'm like, I don't think that's right. 60 pounds? They're like, no, I had 60 pounds on each side. And you're like, oh, there we go. Yeah. Right. But they're consistently doing that. Who cares how they measure, as long as they have the arbitrary measurements that they create and they can fall underneath those. They had a good day. They had a great day. They had a terrible day. There's your regulation.
Yeah. I'm glad you talked about the RPE, because when it shows up in my train heroic from my coach, I'm always a bit like, is it what I want, what I did, or what he wants? what exactly, how am I
a perfect client?
Where's my head today?
Yeah. I love that.
No, I like what you said there about, I think that's really interesting, because I'm thinking back on this, like I've done this a lot of like, oh, somebody says that, I'm like, oh, I've had a tough day. And so you immediately as a coach, like change what you're doing on that. Not saying, well, let's go through this. How does that feel? Actually see what they feel. Because yeah, them going through stress might feel a different RPE. Kind of goes back to the beginning of our conversation when we're talking about magnifying the problem. Like they need to be aware of what the RPE is. I might know what a 7 feels like for me. It's going to feel very different for another
person. Well, some people don't want to feel that.
Yeah.
Right. So you now like you're 7. You're right. If I can keep somebody with a 7 and an 8, that's perfect. Maybe once in a while we push the 10. I got a young lady who never wants to be, you know, at a 10. So how do I like manipulate that 8 feeling that we're still moving, you know, the needle forward?
Yeah.
There's way too many variables to take into consideration. I love RPE. I love using it. And there's a lot of people that have good information. I think it's Mike DeShear's got some good stuff on it. And I think the other guy is Garrett Blessings, I think, that if people are really in tune and they're consistent, you can start to correlate with your percentages and your numbers, but it's what they're doing, not you as a coach. So remember that that RP is about them and not about you. So to answer your question, it's clearly what
you do. Yeah, I think that's the goal, but in my mind still raised.
Yeah.
Also, I haven't heard forgetting Sarah Marshall mentioned without referring to Jason Sudeikis's tender nude scenes. I'm impressed you were able to do that.
We were all thinking it. We were all thinking it.
That's... I imagine.
we'll start singing Van Helsing right afterwards. Yeah. So, all right. I do remember my question now, so I'm getting back
to it.
Okay. So, I thought this was really interesting because I was trying to hang on the words that you were saying today. And you mentioned your journey of going into iron cardio, you know, going from cancer and then getting back, tried some things out like swings and get it. And you said, I wasn't strong enough to be powerful yet. And that's when more of like an iron cardio, which is more of a grind based program, seemed like it aligned a lot more. It's interesting because especially in Strong First, in the kettlebell community, we teach a lot of the ballistics as the first thing. Mm-hmm. But I was almost thinking, like, do you think it's almost more powerful and more important to teach some of the grind work for people who are just getting into training before getting into ballistics?
The answer is yes, somewhere in that mix. A couple of different directions here. Due to my years of training, even though I was detrained, I know how to summate force. I am still a skilled mover, and I am still somebody who knows how to put tension and strength where I want. So even though I was not strong enough to be powerful, I could, and what I mean by that is I could produce more power than my body could handle. That is different from a beginner who cannot produce more power than their body can handle. So and that's like, you know, people who think they're powerful. Cool. You know, I've been on an accelerometer. I've been on a force deck. I know how much I've had people that measure those things go, whoa, when they look at, you know, the results. So I know I'm producing high power, high speed, however you want to refer to it. And my skill at doing that was still very high. My strength and ability to handle that power was very low. So if I'm not very strong, I'm not going to produce high power. So that swing is actually going to have a very different effect for the beginner who is not strong enough to produce high power. So they're not going to be handling high loads anyway. So it's still a good entry point. And I can take advantage of the virtual force of the swing to be doing a deadlift that is far beyond your current deadlift because it's micro-loaded into these seconds of swing in that eccentric load. Has a ton of transfer, and at the same time, I'm building their grinding strength. we're doing some deadlifts, we're doing some presses. And I would humbly say that getting started into iron cardio plus swings, and we're always doing get-ups. That's not a question. A day without get-ups is a bad day.
Agreed.
So I would humbly say that iron cardio plus swings would be a really good program.
We've said many times off camera, iron cardio plus simple sinister might be the perfect program.
100%.
Yeah.
Isn't simple and sinister enough? It's so challenging.
It can be.
It's
yeah, I was going to say so far.
Not going to take over this on my thoughts of sinister training right now. It's a blast. Right. I absolutely love it. Thank you so much for this journey on here. Beautiful. Right. I got one more question that I wanted to dive in with you guys. It's kind of for everyone. It's a bit over, bit big, but we've all been practitioners for a while of training, of kettlebell work and stuff like that. I always like to ask about like the biggest evolutions over time on here, like what you thought at the beginning versus one of the big things that you really changed your mind on or kind of doubled down on now. If you think about the biggest evolution of what you found in your own training right now, what would that be?
I'm not going first.
Start this off. Okay, question. I think dogma, really. Everybody's guilty of it, especially when you go to a cert first time or you get involved in an organization the first time. You're like, this is the way that it is. This is whatever. And you're like, that's stupid. This is great. And it's just this line in the sand. It's black or white. And that's not how it, that's not, nothing works like that. Nothing. Right. So I tend to be more, you know, pragmatic about it in the sense of like, maybe it has a place, maybe not right now. You know, and part of being a coach is recognizing that, like, this might not be right for you right now, or this is right for you right now. So I think the dogma aspect of it is probably the biggest thing. And I think where I get in trouble, air quotes, get in trouble with other coaches and organizations is I'm not dogmatic. And sometimes I just want to argue because I think that it's stupid. It's stupid.
You like to argue.
I do like to argue. No. I like to debate. So I think that's what it is because, you know, I've seen people who, if you really look at their structure or even their genetics, you're like, I don't know how you're moving. You know, how are you even doing this? But you know what? I got to hold you to this standard. And like, that's not going to stick around. You know, those people at the end of the day, we're on this, you know, three quarters of us are in the business of making money in this industry. And you can't be dogmatic in this industry. That just, that's terrible. Yeah.
It's awesome.
I think that I've certainly have come to discover as I get older that kettlebells have taught me more about my body than anything else because they are wholly enigmatic. One day, a 10-32 snatches just feels like you're in the zone, and then a 20 single swing is killing me. And I never understand why or how it's meeting me. And I think it's a little bit of surrender, you know, finding, meeting the orb where it is, where letting the orb meet me where I am and allowing it to be that. I think early when I was training, particularly when I was training for level two and I was really in a zone, I thought, well, this is now the zone I'm at. I'm here now. This is how it's always going to be forever. And I look back and for a while I would look back at videos of me doing things and think, oh, I'm not able to do that. And now I look and I think that's just part of what I've been able to do. And I'm doing other things now. And I don't feel any negativity around it. And it makes me love it even more. So I've had an uneasiness around it when I stepped away from training or moved towards barbells for a period of time. But I think I've learned more about my body and what it can do. Maybe that's not answering your exact question, but in the long term, that's how I've regarded it.
That's perfect.
Yeah, love it. I think as somebody that's been teaching certifications and to DJ's point, one of the things that I am passionate and hammering away at right now is do not lose the student in the standard. There are, when you set up testing, you have to have standards, right? There has to be the reason they took the press out of Olympic lifting was 11 degrees of leaning back okay, but 12 wasn't. How are you going to measure it? How do we make these things the same so that we have this level playing field so that competition means something? Same thing when you're setting up testing standards. There are certain things that we're going to look for, but in squatting, for example, a short torso, long femur person is going to look very different squatting than a short femur, long torso person. Did I just say the same thing twice, or did I say the opposite?
That's correct.
Can we, okay. Can we review the tape?
Okay. Yeah. I can never, anyway, I meant whatever I said, I meant the opposite. And if I said the opposite, I meant the opposite. Work on that at home. So, you know, but yet they can still meet the same basic standards. It broke parallel. The lower back was maintained. The knees track toes, heels stay planted. There's some very basic things within that movement that can be consistent amongst a wide variety of body types. And then there are special situations where somebody comes in and an elbow doesn't fully extend. Okay, well now, you know, that's how this is going to look for this individual. And they still meet standard because they're never going to check this box, but that's because their elbow won't fully extend. Mm-hmm. So there's a way to make all of that happen. I think, and because you've given me room to pontificate, I shall do so. I think that's from more like the management side of things and running certifications and things like that. From a coaching side of things, it's really embracing the richness of cueing, looking at not only having good auditory verbal cueings, but kinesthetic and auditory from the standpoint of like sound effects. You know, for a new student, bloop, bringing the cleans bloop, up into the rack very softly, like that auditory cue is kind of like, oh, like the, you know, the clean starts to coordinate around that.
I love the TikTok today with the half meal TikTok.
I know, that was actually really helpful.
Yeah, exactly. So it's these auditory cues that give the impression idea. It's the kinesthetic cues that are going to give you the feeling that I want you to have. And it's allowing time for those things to click in. One of the things we'll fall into as coaches, we want our correction to work right now, the next rep. And so I gave you this cue. So now every rep after this should be to that new cueing, that new standard. Yeah, that's not going to happen. That cue that I dropped for you 3 weeks ago might come home today after you've practiced for another 3 weeks. It is accepting where the person is right now, knowing where I want them to take them, and allowing them the time to get there. Now, as somebody who's been up on stage presenting, and you do the magic trick, you do the thing that changes movement right now, and everybody goes, oh my gosh, did you see what just happened? Okay, that is a little bit of a magic trick on stage. What I'm doing for my students at home is knowing that we're on a 4-week journey. Now, you know, I can create quick change. That's not change. It's just quick change. Quick change becomes adaptation by encouraging that again and again and again, and just allowing time for that to happen. So I would say, if anything, I'm just a way more patient coach, and I'm trying to do things that put the movement into my students' hands, brains, things like that. Visual cueing was the other thing that I was kind of stumbling over there, using mirroring, using effective demonstration. Then kinesthetic and then auditory, working way more with that mix so that I create this sensory rich environment. Nick Winkelman was one of the people that, you know, kind of really started me down this path of, you know, how do I make this such a rich sensory experience for you that you can't help but get it? Mm-hmm. You can't help but improve because I've made this rich world for you to live in and to learn from.
Yeah. Love that.
Mike, do you have a response to your question?
I'm feeling like from all of you actually right now. So that's the benefit of going last. I know, exactly. So I think, you know, what you said, like, don't lose the student and the standard. I think I've taken from that just the awareness of your body and what it does for you. And then, but I really resonate a lot with what you said about the dogma, which I think the biggest thing that I've seen is the differentiation between optimal versus practical. And I think, you know, we live in a world of optimization. I made a joke the other day at a presentation where I'm like, there's an invention called the squatty pot. We've optimized how to take a shit. It's like, we've been doing it for a long time. Yeah. It's like, but somebody found a best way to do it. So everybody's, we're always looking for the best way. And when we're talking with people, especially if we're in the coaching business, we're working with individuals. Like, we have tools, we have systems that we work with, but you're working with a person and they're looking for optimal. But if you actually give them the most practical thing and treat them like an individual and a human being, then actually the practical becomes the optimal. And I think the biggest thing that I saw, there was a guy I had on the podcast, Joel Cochran, who said, as coaches, like, we're not teaching people strength. We're not teaching people like all these things. If we can teach them how to be confident in themselves and they have self-confidence, then they buy into not just your program, but they buy into themselves and they're going to do everything to build themselves into their life. So
that's really well put.
Yeah. So, I mean, but the biggest thing, I mean, I've learned so much from doing this show for this time. Cause when you talk about like dogma, like, I was very much in a zealot mindset early on in my career of like thinking this is the best way, cause it's given me a lot, but I've had GS people on this show that have taught me so much about things. I've had mindset coaches on here who have a completely different idea about neuroscience and stuff. And it makes you realize, like, yeah, there is so much information to do. And so a lot of people are just, we're trying to aim up. And it's like, you can learn from every different thing that you're doing. There's not one best way. Because as we said, like, oh, I can't believe I didn't know this. I just learned it today. What are we going to know again in 5 years?
Yeah. It's also like when you go into a coaching as a student, you have an idea of what you want.
Yeah.
But then so much can be shown to you. And for all through my 30s, I basically had trainers to get laid frequently so that I looked good enough. And then... when
there's always a level of vanity.
But when I started training with Tim Barrett, my coach who I'm still with, and I said what I wanted aesthetically, he's like, yeah, we're not going to do any of that. But if you do this, it'll work out. He didn't even get elaborate about it, but it changed my body entirely in my 40s.
Yeah.
Just by the work we did, that wasn't his goal. He was like, that's just going to be the effect.
Yeah. So I think it's great. I mean, cause we work with people. And we're all working with people and we're trying to reach people from things that we do like this and stuff like that. So guys, I appreciate you so much for coming on and doing this. This was an unbelievable weekend. Great to break bread with you guys and share space and be able to do this in person on this podcast. It was a huge pleasure. So thank you so much, guys.
Thanks for having me.
All right, guys. So DJ Whittaking, Queen City Kettlebell, Mark Subias, Brett Jones, go follow them in the show notes. You guys know what to do. Catch you guys in the next one. All right. Peace. Thank you so much for joining me today. I hope you found some great value here. And if you like this episode, please drop a comment and leave us a 5-star rating and review. It does more to build the show than you can imagine. And do not forget to check out and join the Strength Connection Facebook group. In this group, I share the biggest takeaways and lessons from these amazing conversations, as well as training and strength tips for pursuing mastery and fulfillment in life. This group is filled with individuals looking to take full control over their strength, and it's the perfect space to explore new ideas and to share your journey. You'll also get exclusive access to the Strength Connection Mastery Seminars. It's a deep dive into the physical, mental, and spiritual training that you can begin using immediately. So do not wait. Go now. Seriously, go. All right, much love to you. Thank you so much, and I'll catch you on the next one.